You're listening to the Judicial Watch weekly update with Tom Fitton.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. Thank you for joining us this week. As always, on social media, a lot going on in our battle to save the Republic, really, from the ongoing threats of corruption and an effort, frankly, by the left to undo our Republican form of government. We have new emails about Joe Biden. Basically, they're his secret alias emails from his days as vice president. Some interesting news there. Outrageous details of woke mandatory training, it looks like, in the IRS. So they're using your tax dollars that they said they desperately needed to fund IRS operations, essentially to brainwash investigators there with racial separatist training, critical race theory, DEI, et cetera. And plus, there are significant developments in the court cases concerning Donald Trump. We got the Hunter Biden issue. We've got all sorts of other developments with related to government spending that is related to government corruption that I also want to talk about. And maybe we'll just start off with the big news this week, highlighting the corruption behind the prosecutions of President Trump. Now, just to bring you back up to speed, in case you haven't been paying attention for the last 2 years, the Democratic Party is trying to turn the United States into a one-party state by eliminating the candidate who's most likely to oppose and be on the ballot if things are allowed to proceed against President Biden. That is former President Trump. They're trying to jail him, throw him off the ballot, and you know all of that. And of course, the vehicles through which they're doing it are this Jack Smith prosecution up here in Washington, D.C., prosecution in Florida over the fake documents case, and the prosecution up here in D.C. is trying to jail him for disputing the election. Fannie Willis, a Democratic politician in Georgia, Fulton County, Georgia, is also trying to jail Trump and other innocents for daring to dispute the election, as is their God-given right under law. And then, of course, you have a Democratic politician prosecutor in New York who's trying to jail Trump on just, frankly, charges made up out of whole cloth in terms of the plausibility of anything illegal having happened. But the big news this week is that one of the defendants in the cases in Fulton County, his lawyer filed a pleading with the court that suggests that the corruption involved in targeting Trump, which is an abuse of power in my view, right? The politicization of our law enforcement and prosecutorial powers to punish your political enemies, which is, you know, something that no Republicans can suffer through if we hope to continue, is also marred by personal corruption in the targeting of Trump. And I guess that's no surprise, right? So the allegation is that Fannie Willis, and by the way, the Fannie Willis prosecution is really outrageous in the sense that, you know, it's one thing, you know, Trump's a big guy, right? And he can be targeted, you know, in theory, he's a billionaire, and so he's going to be able to protect himself, you know, in a more straight, without as much difficulty as some a citizen who are, and citizens and officials in Georgia, in the political party, the Republican political party, and activists who were also being charged there. And so that Fannie Willis prosecution is particularly abusive. And this was my first reaction to it when it first came out. I was up on our roof talking about it.
Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here with the latest on the crazed indictment of President Trump down in Fulton County, Georgia. It's all about power politics. It's not about the rule of law. And frankly, there's a national Democrat conspiracy to try to jail Trump in the middle of the presidential election. Four indictments in about 5 months. Who are they kidding? This is nothing but politics. And most dangerously, they're trying to criminalize core First Amendment speech. They don't want anyone to dispute elections. And if they don't like what they're saying, as they're seeing in Fulton County, they'll try to jail you, not only President Trump, but other people around him. We're doing their jobs under law, and exercising their rights as free people in the United States of America. I think any government official, both in Georgia, here in Washington, D.C., and up in New York, have a responsibility to shut down these craven and politicized indictments of President Trump. Our republic is at stake.
I should play that every week. We should play that like five times a day, because it was true then, and it's true now. And I'm going to get into where the other opportunities are to shut this down. But that's where we stand. But on top of that political corruption I'm talking about, there's this personal corruption as highlighted in this legal brief raised by the lawyers for a Mr. Michael Roman, who is pushing back against the attack on him, who is, again, he's one of the defendants in the Fulton County case. And I went and looked at the brief, and what I try to do and share my views with folks on Twitter about what I read in terms of these legal briefs, it's like, I'm not a lawyer. I've read a lot of legal briefs, though, and one of the things as a layperson, you read enough legal briefs, and you're trying to communicate with the public about what you're reading, you try to focus on what is in the public interest there. What are people going to be interested in? What are the important points? And I try to share that not only here, but in social media and other places, because we're just trying to educate people about what's going on. And I've carefully reviewed, and I'll just read from the tweet, because it's I think it's important, because you're not going to get the full description or an adequate description from the big media. They have an interest in summarizing it in a way to minimize the scandal here. I've carefully reviewed a new court filing by one of the defendants caught up in Georgia Democratic politician Fannie Willis's unprecedented scheme to jail Trump and other Americans for attempting to dispute the 2020 election. The explosive court filing alleges that Ms. Willis and her appointed special prosecutor, Nathan Wade, who is helping direct the prosecution of these matters, have been having an affair and have in effect been using the controversial prosecutions to improperly convert tax monies, upwards of $1 million it looks like, for their personal use and benefit. The filing alleges ethics violations and potential criminal violations of state and federal law. The defense team for defendant Michael Roman also asked the court to dismiss the indictment and disqualify Willis, Wade, and their offices from any further involvement in the prosecution. And as I noted, it would be no surprise, given the obvious political abuse of power in these Get Trump prosecutions, that there would be also base personal corruption by the Democratic politician running this and her special prosecutor. The introduction, and this is what I read, of the astonishing legal brief, which could very well upend the whole prosecution, follows. And this is where I go into the substance of the brief, so bear with me here. The instant motion, and this is the introduction, my understanding is the attorney who filed this brief is well established and well respected in the jurisdiction there in Fulton County, Georgia. So Mr. Roman evidently hired a smart local criminal attorney who just did what she had to do to defend her client in terms of examining these conflicts of interest that could potentially place his rights under the Constitution at risk. So the fact that this brief was filed by this specific lawyer, I'm led to believe, is significant because this lawyer's reputation is so high within the legal community there in Fulton County. The instant motion is not filed lightly, nor is it being filed without considerable forethought, research, or investigation. Nonetheless, this motion must be heard, as the issues raised herein strike at the heart of fairness in our justice system, and if left unaddressed and unchecked, threaten to taint the entire prosecution, invite error, and completely undermine a public confidence in the eventual outcome of the proceeding. There are fewer positions of authority in Georgia's justice system more powerful than an elected district attorney. The district attorney has incredible control and influence over the entire criminal judicial process, including the power to decide who and when to charge and how to charge them, which cases will get tried and which cases will be resolved, and importantly, the power to allocate public monies provided for the operation of the district attorney's office. Historically, there have been few checks on this power in Georgia, and district attorneys have largely been able to act with broad discretion in deciding how to utilize public monies and making prosecutorial decisions. This case presents a unique opportunity for this court to review this authority and determine if the district attorney has overstepped her legal discretion and authority, and whether she and the special prosecutor violated the law and their obligation under the Georgia Rules of Professional Conduct when they engaged in a personal romantic relationship that has ultimately yielded substantial income to the special prosecutor. The important issues raised in the instant motion suggest that the elected district attorney for the largest district attorney's office in the state of Georgia has used the instant prosecution to pay her partner a large sum of money that was originally allotted to clear the backlog of cases in Fulton County following the COVID pandemic. Normally, the district attorney's use of funds allotted pursuant to a county's prior approval would not be newsworthy or illegally actionable, but this case is different. The district attorney sought additional funds from Fulton County to clear the COVID backlog, including making a detailed presentation to the Board of Commissioners in 2021, and she ultimately received those funds for that purpose. But she has not used those funds for that purpose. She apparently has used them to prosecute this case. So even assuming that there were proper and could be forgiven, even within the contours of this prosecution, there is a separate and very important concern about her use of the money. As the layers unfold, it becomes clear that the district attorney and the special prosecutor have been profiting personally from this prosecution at Fulton County's expense. Instead of handling this case within her office, as she could have done given the influx of COVID money, she chose to hire a private special prosecutor to preside over the case. Once again, on its face, this was not earth-shattering and generally well within her discretion, but there are several important facts that distinguish this case from the typical one and which render the indictment invalid as a matter of law. Under Georgia law, the district attorney was required to obtain Fulton County's approval prior to appointing the special prosecutor to work on the case. The reason for this requirement is simple. It ensures that the district attorney cannot act unilaterally with regard to public monies and is subject to the control and supervision of the governing body, i.e. Fulton County, so that the public has confidence in how the money is used. Undersigned counsel has found no evidence that the district attorney sought or received such approval to appoint the special prosecutor from Fulton County. This is not a mere technicality. It is a requirement that the Georgia Supreme Court has held must be followed when a special prosecutor is appointed, and therefore a prerequisite for any special prosecutor's work on a case, including the instant case. Since the district attorney was fully capable of asking for authority for additional funding following the pandemic, then it is clear she knows how to do that. So that begs the question of why she did not do so with regard to the approval for the special prosecutor in this case. One could assume it was an oversight, but digging deeper, the potential reasons become obvious. As has been pointed out in prior followings, the special prosecutor's oath of office was never filed. While this may have been an oversight, it may have been purposeful, a specific attempt to shield from public knowledge the fact the special prosecutor had in fact been appointed without legal authority. Perhaps more important and enlightening, however, is the identity and qualifications of the specific person the district attorney chose to put in charge of the prosecution. I mean, this is quite the potboiler, isn't it, huh? This is quite the setup. The district attorney chose to appoint her romantic partner, who at all times relevant to this prosecution has been a married man. Admittedly, this is a bold allegation, considering it is directed to one of the most powerful people in the state of Georgia, the Fulton County District Attorney. Nevertheless, the district attorney's fame and power do not change the fact she has decided to appoint as the special prosecutor a person with whom she had a personal relationship and who is now leading the day-to-day prosecution of this case. even assuming this type of nepotism might be forgiven in the abstract. A review of the amount of money that the special prosecutor has been paid by the district attorney and the personal activities of the district attorney and a special prosecutor during the pendency of this prosecution shed light on just how self-serving this arrangement has been. The court may be wondering, and for good reason, how do you know this? Why does it matter? And how do we know this? This is the next section. Open records requests to Fulton County. Oh, they're doing a little judicial watch work down there, huh? Open records request. FOIA can be your savior sometimes, especially if you're under prosecution, it looks like. Open records requests to Fulton County reveal that the district attorney did not obtain county approval to appoint the special prosecutor. Why would the district attorney not obtain this approval prior to appointing the special prosecutor? The special prosecutor has admitted his oath was not filed prior to work on this case. Why would the special prosecutor not file the oath? A simple administrative task for the lawyer. The special prosecutor is seeking a divorce in Cobb County and sought successfully to seal these records, hiding them from public view. Why would a private citizen such as the special prosecutor shield filings related to his income and spending from public view? While filings in the divorce are sealed by court order, the legality of which is open to question. Information obtained outside of court filings indicate that the district attorney and special prosecutor have traveled personally together to such places as Napa Valley, which is in California, Florida, and the Caribbean, and the special prosecutor has purchased tickets for both of them to travel on both the Norwegian and Royal Caribbean cruise lines. Traveling together to such places as Washington, D.C. or New York City might make sense for work purposes in light of other pending litigation, but that work purpose could only be served by travel to this, but what work purpose could only be served by travel to this tradition, to these traditional vacation destinations? The district attorney and the special prosecutor have been seen in private together in and about the Atlanta area and have believed to have cohabited in some form or fashion at a location owned by neither of them. Well, I don't think you need to be a detective to read between the lines of that allegation, right? Sources close to both the special prosecutor and the district attorney have confirmed they had an ongoing personal relationship during the pendency of this special prosecutor's divorce proceedings. According to these sources, the personal relationship between the district attorney and the special prosecutor began before this prosecution was initiated and before the district attorney appointed the special prosecutor. I mean, if true, wow. I mean, just think of the implications of what I read thus far. They were seeing each other. They were romantically linked. And this Trump issue, this political issue, political decision to target Trump comes up. And she brings her romantic partner into the program and the prosecution. And the incentive for the prosecution is to pay her friend, who then pays for vacations for her. So the whole prosecution, it looks like, wasn't about the rule of law. It was about laundering tax money for their own personal benefit. That's what is being effectively alleged here. Undersigned counsel knows the special prosecutor and has researched his litigation experience. That research reveals that the special prosecutor has never tried a felony RICO case. And RICO is the big charge that they're charging Trump with and the others, including this defendant, Mr. Roman. The state of Georgia and the city of Atlanta had several lawyers who specialize in the prosecuting and defending RICO cases. Despite having access to these resources, why would the district attorney instead appoint someone who has never tried a felony RICO case, particularly in a case with such national significance as this one? The special prosecutor, based on his lack of experience in this type of felony, would not be qualified under Fulton County standards to be appointed to represent any defendant in this case, given the complexity of the charges. If the special prosecutor is not qualified to defend the case under Fulton County standards, then how is he qualified to prosecute the case? Is that why the district attorney did not seek approval for his appointment? If so, why did she seek to appoint an unqualified lawyer without approval to preside over this prosecution? Since being appointed as special prosecutor, the special prosecutor has been paid an estimated almost $1 million in legal fees. Of course, additional fees would be expected when private counsel is hired, but that would assume that they are not in a relationship with the district attorney and they were qualified to do the work they were hired to do. Almost $1 million. The special prosecutor's fees have been lucrative in comparison to any reasonable measure. The district attorney's yearly salary, including state and county supplements, is $198,266.66. And the total annual budget for the Fulton County District Attorney's Office for fiscal year 2022 was $31.5 million. The district attorney lobbied for additional money from Fulton County to hire lawyers and staff to clear the backlog after COVID. Why didn't she just use that money to hire qualified in-house staff to try the case? Why did she instead use that money to retain the special prosecutor? It's like Peyton Place down there, isn't it? Am I dating myself? I never saw Peyton Place, but I'm old enough to know the reference. As the world turns, rather than Dallas, it's Fulton County. Why is this important? The district attorney's failure to obtain the required approval to appoint the special prosecutor prior to him obtaining indictments against Mr. Roman renders the special prosecutor's service in that role a nullity and without effect under Georgia law. So the indictments he assisted in securing suffer from a structural and irreparable defect and must be dismissed. So they are asking for not only the dismissal of the indictments against Mr. Roman, but all the other defendants, including the former president of the United States, Mr. Trump. In light of the district attorney's personal relationship to the special prosecutor prior to his appointment as special prosecutor, his appointment created an impermissible and an irreparable conflict of interest under Georgia's rules of professional conduct, which requires the disqualification of both lawyers and their respective offices and firms. The district attorney's apparent intentional failure to disclose her conflict of interest to Fulton County and the court, combined with her decision to employ the special prosecutor based on her own personal interests, may well be an act to defraud the public of honest services, since the district attorney, quote, personally benefited from an undisclosed conflict of interest, which is a crime under 18 U.S.C. 1346, as well as a predicate act under which could result in a RICO charge against both the district attorney and the special prosecutor. So she's making allegations of criminal conduct here. Putting aside both the legal and ethical implications of their conduct also undermines the sanctity of the criminal justice system, erodes public trust in our judicial system, and would place them above the law. To allow this conduct to go unchecked by a powerful public elected official threatens to undermine the very principles of democracy that the district attorney herself claims to defend in this prosecution. It seems hard to believe that such a powerful person could escape scrutiny and accountability for such egregious conduct, simply because she believes she maintained a moral high ground and holds one of the powerful positions in the state of Georgia. This is particularly true since she has used that platform and megaphone it provides to tour the country, giving interviews in pursuit of a conviction. It is for these reasons and other important reasons set forth below that the instant motion is being filed. The actions of the district attorney, special prosecutor, are indefensible under the law and our rules of professional conduct. So when they reference rules of professional conduct, those are the rules that lawyers have to follow in order to practice. If they break those rules, their ethics rules, they can be punished, restricted from practice, and or disbarred. ultimately creating a fatal and irreparable defect to the indictment against Mr. Roman and a conflict of interest that has tainted the entire prosecution. To allow either of them to stand above the law would be to invite and encourage the same behavior in the future, as Mr. Roman respectfully requests that the court grant the instant motion and dismiss the indictment in its entirety as to Mr. Roman. Mr. Roman also respectfully requests that the court disqualify Willis, Wade, and their respective offices and firms for any future involvement in the prosecution of the matter. So that was a little bit long. It was probably longer than I anticipated, but I think it was important. I mean, just look at that story of incredible corruption that I found persuasive. Do I know for sure it's true or not? I don't. But as I said, a respected member of the bar in Georgia placed it in the court record. Knowing the allegations were so serious, she better be right. I think it was a female lawyer who did it, in making these allegations. And as best I can tell, Fannie Willis hasn't responded publicly to this. Her special prosecutor friend hasn't responded publicly to this. Ms. Willis has been since subpoenaed in that divorce proceeding involving her special prosecutor friend. But this highlights the base corruption, as I say, in these prosecutions of Trump. Now, I think the prosecution, as Greg Jarrett of Fox News has highlighted, our friend over there, Greg said it should be paused. They're asking for the prosecution to be thrown out. But certainly, given the gravity of these charges and pending allegations, I don't see how any of this process continues until it's resolved. So we'll see what the court does. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I believe, sent a letter to the district attorney, the attorney general for Georgia, asking for a criminal investigation of this. The feds, I would presume, would have an interest in investigating this as well, if they're being honest. So this is, I don't know how it's going to play out, but to me, if this is true, it's just another example of how President Trump is a crime victim. I mean, you had essentially crooks in Fulton County, if these allegations are true, using a specious prosecution of Trump to line their pockets and advance their personal romantic interests. And this wouldn't be the first time, right? It wouldn't be the first time. Remember Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, the lovebirds up in the FBI who were colluding on the Get Trump effort while maintaining, I think they were adulterous relationship in the time. And that came out that they were not only in that relationship, but anti-Trump partisans, and they had been running the Trump investigation. At least Strzok was a key individual there, and in Hillary's investigation too at the time. And then he went over and was working in the Mueller investigation, and then they found the text messages, right? And they had to Mueller kicked them off the team without telling anyone. Tried to cover it up. But eventually it was found out. We've gotten a lot of those text messages, and our pressure exposed a lot of what went on there. And we've got a great production of that. What was it called? I think it's called Lovebirds. We'll do a link to the video. We partnered with some producers out in California who did a live play or filmed a play based on the Lisa Page, Peter Strzok case messages. But you know, there was that sort of corruption, right? Involved in the Trump camp, the anti-Trump effort under Mueller and Obama and the deep state. And it raises questions about these other investigations and highlights the need for transparency in them. Judicial Watch is in federal court right now seeking the names of the team members on Jack Smith's team. Who are they? We want to know who they are. Is it full, you know, the Mueller investigation was full of anti-Trump partisans, Democrats, almost all universally Democrats and leftists. And that, to me, is public information that should be shared as the American people judge any special prosecutor's operation, because they're supposed to be above board and restore confidence that the Justice Department, or inspire confidence that the Justice Department is neutrally and fairly administering the rule of law. But if the whole team is full of anti-Trumpers, obviously that is that doesn't get you to where we want to be. Now, what Jack Smith is telling us is that we can't have the names of anyone who works for him. Oh, we can have the names of people who have been public, meaning if someone signed a legal brief, but the equivalent of an assistant U.S. attorney or a U.S. attorney, because we don't want the names of the secretaries or the clerks and such. But folks who are substantial public employees who are in significant positions of power of influence, why on earth wouldn't we have access to those names? Are there other Fannie Willises and special prosecutor friends like hers on that team? I mean, Jack Smith's position is that he could have Michelle Obama working in his office, and because she doesn't sign any legal briefs, we're not allowed to know about it. So there's significant corruption afoot in Fulton County. The evidence is really quite powerful, as I described to you. And then there's the appearance, I would say there is corruption because I witnessed it in the investigation under Jack Smith. But on top of that, there's the added appearance of corruption in their desperate effort to hide basic information about their operations. Namely, who's working for them? Who are the key people working for them? They don't want us to know. So we're continuing to pursue that federal court case. And we're going to be pursuing these issues related to Fannie Willis as well, as best we know how, under FOIA and the open records law in Georgia. So that's the story of the week. The case against President Trump in Georgia. And by the way, that case wouldn't have proceeded but for them working with the Justice Department, the Biden gang in up here in D.C., and the Pelosi January 6th committee. They were all in on it. I want to know who knew what and when about this special prosecutor, don't you? This independent prosecutor, her friend, that seemingly, according to this lawyer, because I've read, I have it in my head, I've seen stories about the relationship this person had with Fannie Willis beforehand. So my guess is it was well known in the court and in the community down there about their relationship. Terrible, terrible corruption. You know, and we've seen all these abuses, right? We've seen the misuse of tax dollars to turn America into a one-party state by trying to jail Trump, keep him off the ballot, targeting Republicans who dare oppose Joe Biden, trying to jail them in various states, targeting citizen activists who thought they could challenge and dispute the election under the law, just trying to jail them and punish them and retaliate against them, again, to further rig the election. And all of that, Congress has done nothing about. Now, it's one thing if Congress is controlled by the Democratic Party, which is organizing this effort to turn America into a one-party state. But the Congress is controlled by Republicans, at least the House side, and they've done nothing to defund any of this. They're fully funding the abuses of Trump, the effort to turn America into a one-party state. The Biden invasion is just getting worse and worse and worse. That continues to be fully funded. And all the other terrible things we know about is fully funded, such as mass censorship and other abuses by Joe Biden. And the House Republicans, at least the leadership, announced this week with Senator Schumer that they've agreed on so-called top-line budgets. And so the process they're put in place essentially is going to mean, and this is based not just on what they say, but based on my understanding, and discussions with folks here in Washington, D.C., and you know, people who know even more about me than the process, which is a lot of people in Washington. But what they've set in place, Speaker Johnson has set in place with Senator Schumer and Mitch McConnell, is a process that will essentially fully fund everything you don't like about the Biden administration. Now, conservatives may get a few policy successes out of that. They may extract some policy concessions. But generally, the administration is getting everything they want funded. There are opportunities to challenge some of the issues I'm talking about, but no one takes those opportunities seriously because it's clear that Speaker Johnson, working with Senator Schumer, has set up a process that's guaranteed to result in no government shutdown. Why is that important? Because the government shutdown process was seen by conservatives as the only effective tool to stop the worst of the worst in terms of the destruction of the republic. Now, I don't know about you, for instance, but I know if a budget came up that continued the funding of sending illegal aliens all throughout America, I would not vote for it. And I would just make it clear, we can't continue to operate this way. We've got to stop it. It's an emergency. But others, I know, including, you know, the Speaker, don't think that can work. We can wait till next year, he says. Now, it's not to mean he doesn't advocate and doesn't agree with the outcome I'm highlighting, but the tactic in getting to these results, I guess that's where the dispute is. And of course, then we have this Fannie Willis in Georgia. I mean, why hasn't there been any sanction on Georgia, practically speaking, for abusing the civil rights of Donald Trump and others? Now, in light of this corruption, can there be federal funding that's restricted to Fulton County or Georgia generally if they're going to be violating the civil rights of Americans? I think so. I mean, this was a few months ago, and I've got some videos here that were filmed during the McCarthy speakership. Things really haven't changed, so they're still pretty relevant. This one, I guess the one where I'm in the hotel room, I remember doing it because it was like, I was just about to get on a plane. I literally just woke up, but I'm thinking, I got to get this word out because it's going to, you know, whatever the timing was, there needed to be something done quickly. And so let's play that video.
Hey, everyone. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton. Don't forget, Congress has an opportunity over the next 2 weeks to shut down the prosecutions of Donald Trump, to defund them. Don't let Congress fool you. Don't let House leaders fool you. They can do it now. They should do it now. They can protect Trump from these abuses. They can protect other innocent Americans from these abuses. They can stop the Biden Justice Department's interference in our elections. They can do it now through this continuing resolution process. Poll your members of Congress and share your views at 202-225-3121.
So you can see things haven't changed. It's literally the same point, except now move forward a few months. I think January 19th is the next opportunity for a continuing resolution that would at least partially shut down the government. The plan is to kind of let something temporary go on until they get all their appropriations measures in place. I mean, unless you're willing to do something significant for continued spending that the left wants, or get something significant, meaning, you know, the stopping of the abuse of Trump or the ending of the invasion, I don't know how in this emergency situation you could allow the government to stay open. That's my personal opinion. I mean, this is even worse. I participated in a press conference with some conservative leaders, like Kevin Roberts over at Heritage. Senator Lee was there from Utah, and members of the House Freedom Caucus. And, you know, this kind of highlighted it. And again, I just wish this press conference had been overtaken by events. I forget when we did it. Was it September? Yeah, it was probably in September. Literally nothing's changed other than the name of the speaker. Let's go to that tape.
I'm Tom Fitton. I'm president of Judicial Watch, America's leading government watchdog organization. We have a simple request for Congress. Do your job. It's not enough to do investigations and reports. We need to stop the government corruption and abuse that is so concerning to the American people. In this new budget fight, or basically the old budget fight that we're being asked to pretend is new, there's an inflection point. Are we going to continue to fund Republicans in the House the wild abuse by the Biden administration of its political opponents, the mass censorship of tens of millions of Americans, the border invasion we've heard so much about, and the other wild abuses of power that are right now fully funded with Congress? And I don't know what we're talking about with a clean CR. I see a dirty CR, a CR that will fund the worst, the dirty politics and corruption in our federal government. And there's a positive moral obligation right now, not next year, but right now, to stop the abuses, the effort to jail Trump on pretextual, unprecedented charges in a way never seen before in American history. An obligation to stop right now the Biden administration censorship of tens of millions of Americans. The obligation to stop right now the illicit use of tax monies to fund abortions in our military and elsewhere. We need to stop right now the attack on children through the promotion of transgender extremism. We need to stop right now the lack of serious investigation into the Biden administration corruption, specifically Biden corruption. We need a Justice Department or a special counsel that has confidence of the American people. All of these issues can be addressed in this continuing resolution. And if they don't want to address it, that suggests to me those who vote for it are on the side of corruption, and those who oppose it are on the side of justice. Thank you.
You know, when I first tweeted that out, I said, you know, Speaker McCarthy needs to do X. And I realized, oh, no, it's not Speaker McCarthy, it's Speaker Johnson. And, you know, again, to sum up, and this is the tweet I put out that received a lot of follows, or excuse me, a lot of attention. After a series of D.C. meetings and discussions this week, I've concluded that the House and Senate leadership, again, Speaker Johnson, with Schumer and McConnell and the Republican Senate, the Republican leader of the Senate is McConnell, is what I meant to say, have set in motion a political process that will result in the D.C. status quo being fully funded this year with speckles of conservative policy wins here and there. This banana republic level of spending is at the time almost certain to include continued full federal taxpayer funding of Biden's border invasion, the Biden regime Democratic Party effort to turn America into a one-party state by jailing Trump, etc., the mass censorship of Americans and other policies that threaten the very foundations of our Republican form of government. And there's other fights about the border going on right now, kind of separately. It's all part of a piece, but technically separate. It wouldn't surprise me, as I write here, if the uniparty open borders interests even managed to get amnesty for illegal aliens thrown into a Potemkin border security measure. Again, you should share your views about these issues with your senators and congressmen by calling 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. So, like I said, both leaders, both party leaders, want this to move forward in Congress. And the only way to stop it is through effective leadership within the Hill, you know, whether it be good senators in the House, in the Senate, or good members in the House, but also to hear from you, the American people. 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. Call, figure out, you know, you can. They'll help you figure out who your congressman is if you don't, and who your senators are if you don't know them. But share your views politely, yet directly, they do take note. They do take note of these calls when they come in. And even if the call doesn't get picked up, they take note of the volume of calls. So they know the phones are ringing, and they're politicians. There's nothing they are more expert at than figuring out what their voters want. Now, whether they do what their voters want is a different matter. But they certainly know they're finely attuned little squirrels when it comes to figuring out where the winds are blowing politically. And if you want our country to be protected from the invasion, then you really need to get on the horn. I don't know what else to tell you. Now, of course, Judicial Watch will do what we can in terms of uncovering the corruption and providing education to the voter and to citizens about what's going on and what needs to be addressed through spending and funding fights. But it's up to you, dear voter and dear citizen, to follow through. Now, one of the big issues that have popped up online after this was the issue of voting, because people see millions of illegal aliens coming through, and they're wondering what's going on here, and will it undermine election security further? And I've highlighted, and even Elon Musk has taken note of this. He's been quite, red-pilled on these issues. Now, there was a, if you click back, there was a press, there was a, there was a tweet of a woman, congressman, I believe, talking about wanting more illegal aliens in her jurisdiction to increase power, or aliens to increase power. And if I recall correctly, Musk said, is this legal? Is that legal? Yeah. So there it is. Congresswoman saying the quiet part out loud, I need more people in my district just for redistricting purposes. And Musk said, is this legal? Okay, so this is how I responded. Go next to that, because I'm going to need to use the screen to read it to folks. So click on my tweet there. President Trump's effort, so this is what had happened. So I describe quite directly here what the issues are. President Trump's efforts to exclude illegal aliens from being considered for purposes of congressional apportionment was stymied by the courts. Opponents of considering the number of aliens for purposes of apportionment, I'm going to come closer to the screen so I can see it better, highlight how voters in congressional districts with high numbers of aliens effectively have more political power than citizens in districts with fewer aliens. One man, one vote is undermined. Do you understand how that works? It means that if there are congressmen with fewer voters in their district, right, of citizen eligible voters in their district because they have large number of aliens who don't vote in theory. And so those voters have more power in the House and than voters who are in districts with lesser numbers of aliens, because the vote is distributed more broadly in places where there are more citizens. Supporters highlight how the Constitution requires all persons be included in the census and for purposes of apportionment. Now, the left also thwarted, by the way, President Trump's attempts to include a citizenship question in the 2020 census. They didn't even want Trump asking how many aliens were here. There is no doubt that the increasing foreign-born population has a significant impact on congressional representation. In 2019, the Center for Immigration Studies concluded that at least 26 seats in the House would be shifted after the 2020 census due to this foreign population. CIS estimated of the 26 seats that will be lost, 24 from states that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. And now, as I note, I haven't seen any numbers about how the Biden border invasion will affect the next census and congressional reapportionment. But unless these new foreign non-citizens leave or are removed by 2030, or unless the law is changed, one can expect a substantial and potentially historic impact on congressional representation, mostly to the benefit of Democratic-controlled states. Now, Musk responded to that. He saw that, and he replied or quoted it further. Extremely concerning given the recent massive influx of illegal immigrants exceeds babies born in the United States. Now, the left went crazy over that. But that's the reality of it. I fairly describe what the debate is. The debate is, what happens to our right to vote? Is it diluted and kind of distorted as a result of large numbers of foreign nationals living in the United States? Now, the left has a solution to that, guys. You know what they want? They want them all to be able to vote. They don't want to limit the franchise to citizens. They want to expand the franchise to include foreign nationals. So all those folks you're concerned about, well, they're not concerned. They see them as potential voters. Not waiting for them to become citizens, but right now. Here in the District of Columbia, they changed the rules. Now foreign state, national elections, non-citizens can't vote. But localities can let non-citizens vote, or they have. Whether they can under law, I think is questionable, but they have, including here in the District of Columbia, which allows non-citizens to vote. So, I want you to think about this. Your nation's capital, okay, is governed by a mayor and a D.C. council, okay? It's the nation's capital. Federal government's based here. Congress is based here. The president, the White House is based here. We have a massive diplomatic corps, foreign ambassadors here. All of them, in theory, would be able to vote in the District of Columbia. So the Russian ambassador and the Chinese ambassador can help govern your capital through the right to vote. Heck, they could bring in to their embassy, every Chinese national in the embassy could become a voter. In theory, under this new law here in the District of Columbia, which, by the way, Congress also hasn't done anything about, even though Congress constitutionally runs the District of Columbia, our nation's capital. So where they get the chance, they dilute the vote of American citizens by allowing non-citizens to vote, including illegal aliens. So they're not just trying to limit this to green card holders. Green card holders are essentially permanent residents of the United States who are foreign nationals. And the thinking is after a certain number of years, they are eligible to become citizens. No, they're not doing that. If you're here long enough and you're a foreign national, you can vote in some of these jurisdictions. So what's going to happen when there are 10 million more foreign nationals? As I note, there's not only a distortion in how Congress is apportioned, but it provides a voting, a contingent of voters for politicians at the local level where these laws are being changed. So what's happening, my guess is in places like New York, my understanding generally is, New York and California generally are losing population, losing residents in terms of citizens leaving, but they're protected from losing congressional seats because the foreign-born population, the foreign national population is increasing. And under the current law, they get credit for that in terms of their congressional representation. So that's mitigated their terrible policies that are causing Americans to leave. Don't result in less congressional representation necessarily, or it's mitigated. And, Elon is also focused on, and I've been trying to educate Americans through my Twitter feed on this as well, and again through this broadcast here, is that non-citizens, it's virtually impossible to let me be careful here. Non-citizens can easily vote illegally in federal elections. Why is that? Because there's no citizenship verification in order to register to vote. All there is on the federal form that states are required to use is a question: are you a citizen? Yes or no? Now, if you falsely attest that you are a citizen, you are subject to prosecution. But that assumes someone catches you and they investigate every form to make sure it's accurate. But no one asks you when you fill that form out, well, show me you're a citizen. Provide me a record showing you're a citizen. And then once they are registered to vote, if the alien, whether they be illegal alien or legal alien, lawfully present or unlawfully present alien, if they register to vote, they're essentially in like Flint, because even in a state where voter ID is required, aliens will often have the voter ID necessary to vote, even if they're illegally registered. So what's the solution there? Voter ID is not enough. Asking people to affirm they're a citizen is not enough, especially when you have countless millions of non-citizen individuals here in the United States. But there's got to be a better way, and the better way is to verify citizenship in order to allow someone to register to vote and then vote. Now, the left disapproves of that. They don't like voter ID. They don't like anyone asking anyone for their citizenship proof in order to vote. And on top of everything else, they, you know, we've got the mail-in balloting, which makes it nearly impossible to detect voter fraud and intimidation. We have third parties collecting ballots through ballot harvesting. Republicans, it seems to me, spend more time thinking of how to take advantage of that process rather than end it, which ballot harvesting is an affront and an abomination to free and fair elections. And they don't spend as much energy as they should, honest Republicans and Democrats, trying to stop that fraudulent or potentially fraudulent activity, or activity that invites fraud in a way that undermines confidence in the elections that can never be recovered. So I hope you have a better understanding of how the invasion of illegal aliens can impact your right to vote, can impact your representation in Congress, impact the power of your individual vote, and undermine election integrity. Because the left would have you believe no aliens are voting. And of course they are. They're voting illegally. They do it. It's rarely checked. I mean, you don't enforce the law, then you say, well, no one's breaking the law. I mean, that's the left's approach on voter fraud. Well, you know, there's no serious investigations of to assure that non-citizens aren't voting. So, I mean, there are, what, I think there are 40 million adults who are not eligible to vote in the United States, last I checked. It's tens of millions in the least. None of them are voting? That's not serious. A lot of news going on. Hunter got referred for contempt to the full House. He showed up like something out of The Godfather, a mafioso sitting in the committee room. I think some people have said he was trying to get good video for a documentary he was trying to make some money off of. So he goes to the committee that he refused to testify to sit in the committee room. I don't know, to intimidate them? I mean, what was going on there? Like I said, it was like a mafia scene. He left after 10 minutes, but they voted him in contempt, and now it will go to the full floor. As I said earlier, and it's been confirmed six ways to Sunday, and through even admissions by the White House, Joe and Hunter colluded and conspired on this obstruction and contempt of Congress, and Joe Biden should be investigated as much as Hunter is, assuming this goes past the floor. Now, what happens is next week, there's supposed to be a floor vote by the full House on the contempt referral to the Justice Department of Hunter Biden for violating, I think it's two subpoenas. I didn't realize there were two subpoenas he had avoided pursuing. After it, and just before I came on here, it was reported that his lawyers are trying to save him. And they said, well, you now have an official impeachment proceeding, and our early objections to your subpoena aren't necessarily there anymore, so you give us a new subpoena and we'll set up a deposition as what the House wanted earlier. So it looks to me like they may defer on the referral if they get him nailed down on a deposition date. But it just highlights the obstruction, right? I mean, it's all a game. And Hunter was out in California pleading not guilty to tax charges which are been narrowed and constricted to protect Joe Biden from being implicated. So I saw the not guilty proceeding, the arraignment proceedings in California where Hunter pled not guilty, as just evidence of obstruction of justice and cover-up by the Justice Department. Because the key issues related to Joe, by all accounts, were kept out of the underlying investigation, which meant they let statute limitations issues lapse, and they specifically avoided other legal issues that could implicate Joe Biden and other family members directly. But so as the Justice Department engages in cover-up for Joe Biden, and the House doesn't really know what to do about Hunter as they investigate him, it's all a game up there. Judicial Watch just keeps on keeping on, right, with our FOIAs and our investigations. And Judicial Watch had filed a lawsuit last year for records of the essentially the Biden crime family. We wanted to know from his days as vice president what records were there related to his family and other individuals involved in the Biden family business operations, as we've alleged. And of course, the National Archives, which holds these records, because they're from President Obama's term and when Biden was vice president there, the Archives, which by the way, is trying and desperate to jail Trump, working with the Biden Justice Department, was ignoring the rule of law under FOIA and not giving us the document. So we had to sue. And once we began the suit, you know, all this news came out about the alias emails that Joe Biden had. He didn't have, like, I guess maybe he did, but he didn't use regularly the joebiden@whitehouse.gov or vp@whitehouse.gov. He had alias accounts he used to conduct business, government business on those on these White House servers. So in theory, those records should still be with the archives. And so we said, you better be sure to search any alias email accounts. Now, I talked about a few weeks ago how the first batch of documents we got from that lawsuit, by the way, these are records, by the way, Congress hasn't been able to get yet. They're desperate to get the alias emails. And Judicial Watch is getting them first, by all accounts. We found that Joe and Hunter received an email. So Hunter was CC'd on this email, carbon copied, about Joe being briefed on a meeting and the timing of a meeting with the then president of Ukraine. Why was Hunter involved in that? Interesting, isn't it? Given his role in Burisma and other Ukraine-related corruption and Joe's role there. But since then, we received another batch of documents, and in total, I think we have about 210 emails that Joe Biden received or sent through various email accounts. I think the one account that pops up, he uses Robin Ware, R-O-B-I-N-W-A-R-E, 456 at gmail.com. So he wasn't even using a White House account. It was a Gmail account to conduct government business. And no, that's not necessarily illegal, by the way. It's not necessarily illegal. If you conduct government business on a personal account, you're not necessarily prohibited, depends on the agency rules, but you're required if they're government business emails to CC your own email account and preserve a copy under records laws, or so many have argued that should be the case. You know, like all areas of the law, I've been doing this for 25 years at Judicial Watch. Everyone argues about everything. So what I'm saying is to what's required under records law, you could have 10 lawyers expert in government records, actually 10 Judicial Watch lawyers expert in government records, and there would be quite the energetic discussion about what is required and what should be required. So of the 210 emails, there are a lot of interesting emails, but they show generally that James Biden, President Biden's brother, this is again from his days as vice president, Hunter Biden, Beau Biden, who was alive, obviously, at the time, was getting a lot of government-related emails from the vice president's office and Joe Biden. And there was one peculiar email. Secret Service coverage. Now, generally, the children, oftentimes the grandchildren of presidents, get Secret Service protection. And yet, there's this time in August of 2016 where they waive the Secret Service protection for Hunter Biden and Beau Biden's daughter, I think, Natalie. And there it is. Thank you. Both the vice president and I sign off on the agreed upon requested interruption in protection for Natalie and Hunter. I see that Robert I. Peters. I think that's also the vice president's alias account. So they were all going to Kosovo for a few days. And for some reason over there in Kosovo, they were building a statue to Beau Biden and dedicating a highway or something. And why wouldn't he have Secret Service protection there? I mean, where did he go without the Secret Service protection? We don't know. And that raises the obvious issue. Is that the whole point? So we don't know. And what's interesting is that Judicial Watch had previously uncovered through Secret Service records, because this is what I love about Judicial Watch. If you know the way the government operates, it's kind of an obvious way of getting information, but not many people think like we do in terms of figuring out how to get information. So, you typically can't get records from the White House about who they're traveling with. They've got this discretion. You can't sue them directly. You have to wait for years after the fact. But you can get records from the Secret Service about what they're doing. So we received Secret Service records about their protection of Hunter, what they were, where they were going, and the expenses associated with that. And we found that Hunter went on, I don't know, how many trips? 29 countries? 41 trips? 5 trips to China? One of which at least was on Air Force Two, was Secret Service protection. So we're not denying that he needed Secret Service protection. We think it's appropriate they get Secret Service protection, or at least I think. But why was he traveling all over the world like that, other than to trade on his father's name and get the racket going? And what's interesting is Hunter, I don't think this is official, but it's well understood that Hunter gave up the Secret Service protection, I think, about 6 years into Obama's presidency. There were 2 years or so where Hunter wasn't protected by the Secret Service. And again, you can guess why. Now, he was in the thrall of his drug addiction, and maybe that was a reason why. And I hope he's over it. I mean, I don't wish that on anyone. But the left likes to use, and the Biden regime likes to use, his drug addiction as an excuse for his other misconduct involving his father, and that's not obviously right. So why didn't he want Secret Service protection for those 2 years? What was he doing? I think those are all fair questions. And why was he in Kosovo? Why did they have this weird interruption for Secret Service protection when he was there for this big event in honor of his brother, his deceased brother? Very strange. So once again, it's Judicial Watch to the rescue here, getting the Biden emails that show, as I say in our press release, that Joe Biden and his family had a close working relationship on government matters. No wonder the Biden administration has been hiding these emails from Congress and the American people. So this is another example of Judicial Watch being able to get records that Congress could not get or has not gotten yet on an important issue, which is the relationship between Joe Biden and his family in terms of government business at the White House. Now, obviously, we can't get the records now, at least directly. Congress can. I don't know where they stand on that. But if they do is, if they can't get records from 8 years ago, I have a hard time thinking they're going to get records that the White House has showing contemporaneous activities of the President of the United States. So we'll see how that works. Before I go, there's another big story. I know this is a bit longer than our usual update, but it's so full of information. IRS, we found out through a whistleblower that IRS criminal investigators were subjected to some crazed propaganda program under DEI. Now, one of the big fights in Washington these days is the $80 billion in extra dollars that Biden rammed through Congress and the efforts by Republicans and conservatives to try to claw some of that back. Well, now we know where some of this money is being spent, which is subjecting investigators in the IRS to woke training. Federal agents, and this is in our Corruption Chronicles blog. I encourage you, in addition to watching yours truly here on wherever you're watching me, and my colleague Chris Farrell and all our other videos, we've got a great website that has some great reporting on it through our Corruption Chronicles blog and our investigative bulletin. And so there are stories there you won't read in any other media. They're exclusive to Judicial Watch in terms of exposing what's going on in government corruption. And I don't often get to them here on our weekly update because I focus on our big general press releases and these big stories out there. But I encourage you to go to our website and track our product, right? Our educational product on what the government's up to. So in this case, the Judicial Watch received through a whistleblower copies of the material that was used in this DEI workshop. And federal agents, and this is how we open it up, we'll get to that later. Federal agents charged with investigating money laundering, public corruption, counterterrorism, and narcotics trafficking at the Internal Revenue Service were pulled from their critical duties to endure woke training that directs them to operate in a culturally inclusive environment and speak up for multiple social identities. The drills focused on equity, diversity, inclusion, and justice, and instructed agents from the specialized IRS Criminal Investigation Unit to question how much they know about different cultural norms and mores and challenge them with the following inquiries. Are you prepared to adequately to accommodate different cultural expectations and practices? Can you deliver cultural inclusion behaviorally? The course's introduction titled Cultural Inclusion is About Justice was provided by a black transgender professor who asserts in an academic article that the high impact of, quote, whiteness oppresses trans college students. What is going on? And this isn't like something, you know, people like say, oh, this is crazy. To me, it is corrupt. It is illegal. I want you to see the first. Now let's put up the first slide that our whistleblower gave us there. So this is what they're talking about. Cultural inclusion is about justice. Equity. Equity doesn't mean equity in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Equity means communism. Whose culture is trying to get in the room but can't? Now culture is a code word here for race. I mean, they're not talking about French culture. They're talking about racial cultures. So they know, they're smart enough to know they don't want to say whose race is trying to get in the room but can't. How has everybody's culture been heard? Whose culture is not being taken seriously? What are we talking about here? We're all Americans. Look at this justice line. Whose cultural safety is being sacrificed to allow the dominant culture to degrade the subordinate culture? That's all racialism. Is this cultural under inclusion, diversity, inclusion, equity, see, DEI? Is this cultural environment safe to make people feel that they belong? Well, they're Americans. Let's go to the next slide, see what's there to make me angry. What are your cultural behaviors, values, biases, preconceived notions, and personal limitations? Tell us how your race impacts your, makes you a terrible person. That's what they're saying, and it's not directed at minorities, it's directed at what they call the dominant culture, whites. With your culturally different customers, colleagues, what does that mean? I mean, if they're talking about, I'm an IRS investigator, and you are working in the immigrant community, I mean, I think there should be some training about some sensitivities there. That's not objectionable. Let's say you go into a community that's largely, many of the individuals there speak English as a second language. I wouldn't know necessarily some tricks of the trade in terms of understanding their approach to the IRS and whatever issue. So, I mean, to me, that's not a big deal. Here, they mean race when they talk about culturally different customers and colleagues. They're not talking about like a language difference or a bunch of Frenchmen living in northern Vermont or ethnic French Americans in northern Vermont. You know what I mean. This is crazy town. Let's go to the next slide. Oh, this one got me great. Are you culturally intelligent? Read that to mean, are you racially intelligent? How interesting or relevant is it for you to operate in a culturally inclusive environment? What does that mean? How much do you know about different cultural norms and mores? Again, what does that mean? We're supposed to treat fellow Americans like they're children, and we have to walk around because they somehow think differently and operate differently than the dominant culture? What really troubles me about this Marxist approach, this racial separatist approach is, and frankly it should trouble minorities, is that it treats minorities like children that need to be mollycoddled, right? That there's no assumption that they're Americans too, and we're just going to work together in our jobs. They're treated by race first, and the left refuses to move past that. And to the degree that race becomes the number one issue in hiring, firing, or the operations of an organization, a business organization, that's contrary to law. It's discriminatory. Can you deliver cultural inclusion behaviorally? What does that mean? And I know what it means. It means communism. It means Marxism. It means treating the people according to their race rather than their based on merit and their contributions to the cause of the organization or the mission of the organization. And what does this have to do with IRS criminal investigations? I don't know if I can take many more slides like this, but you get the picture. Let's go to the next one. Just when I think it can't get worse, it gets worse. Look at this first one. You can make an individual mistake without it being attached to your culture. So if you make a mistake, is it going to, it's because you're white or black? I mean, what's going on here? You represent your race? I mean, this is like South Africa during apartheid. This is what the left has embraced. This is the apartheid way of governing and operating in our institutions. Let's go to the next one, see what's there. Oh, this is the way they treat minorities. They are kind of encouraging minorities to pretend that they're being abused and having to hide their culture. What does that mean? Try to blend in with the dominant culture. What is the dominant culture? Go to the next one. Go back one. Well, I guess this one isn't showing up. Well, anyway, you get the point. All of them are up on our website. Let's go live again. And as we further report, the source connected to the Washington, D.C., this is mandatory, by the way. What I showed you is mandatory. I mean, I'm outraged just having to read it as a citizen, knowing taxpayer money is being used to abuse IRS government employees with this. But imagine having to, like, do this as part of your job. Your salary depends on it. Your job depends on it. No American should be put in that situation. Mandatory continuing professional education for all staff. That's what that system, those slides were part of, that DEI program. Source connected to the Washington, D.C. field office provided slides from the specific presentation in that division, which has dozens of agents that investigate crimes throughout the Capitol area, including Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia. So in many ways, this is kind of what our IRS is doing. Rather than being allowed to investigate Hunter and Joe and their racketeering, they're going through DEI training. Federal agents, as well as a special agent in charge of the DE office, work on high-profile probes involving bribery, embezzlement, illegal kickbacks, and dismantling major drug and money laundering organizations. And they were obviously reluctant, according to our reporting, to be yanked from their important work to participate in the woke training. They want us to consider people's race, said a veteran investigator. Criminals don't discriminate. White-collar criminals are mostly what we go after here in the IRS investigative unit. And they are a diverse bunch. His point was, you want diversity. Look at the targets of our investigation. They come from all parts of the world and have all sorts of diverse characteristics. And of course, this is all as a result of the all-hands, all-of-government approach to pushing DEI and critical race theory by the Biden administration. It is their number one priority. And I don't say that because I'm criticizing them. It's because they say that it's their number one priority. It is a priority for other agency to consider equity, diversity, and inclusion in everything they do. You start going on to the... I just encourage you, just pick one agency and just go down the rabbit hole. Just go pick a website of EPA, HHS, you name it, CIA, State Department, and just start going into their diversity sections, and you'll see what I mean. They're all doing it, especially in our military. We've highlighted how they're abusing our poor rising leadership trainees in our national military academies. And of course, once you're in the military full time, they make you go through these trainings as well. So this is an important story. I hope Congress starts paying attention to this, stops funding it. But you can trust your Judicial Watch to get to the truth of the matter on these abuses of government power and the assault on the rule of law. It's one thing to have a bunch of criminals running around. It's another thing to have your government acting in a way that's outside the law. And so we're going to keep on with the heavy lifting on behalf of you, the American people. And again, if you like what you heard today, if you think the work we're doing is important, if you think the message we're putting out there and the educational effort my colleagues and I are making, the lawsuits we're filing, the investigations we're pursuing are important, I encourage you to support our work. Go to judicialwatch.org and make a donation. That's it. Just make a donation. Join our cause, join our movement, support Judicial Watch. And with that, I'll see you here next week on the Judicial Watch Weekly Update.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.